I was a bit rusty, but added that it couldn't look worse than it did already. "Thanks for that," he said. I set to work, letting his hair slide through my fingers, trying to remember the few basics I'd learned. Will, watching the film, seemed relaxed and almost content. Occasionally he told me something about the film, what else the lead actor had starred in, where he had first seen it, and I made a vaguely interested noise, like I do with Thomas when he presents me with his toys, even though all my attention was actually focused on not mucking up his hair. Finally, I had the worst of it off, and whipped around in front of him to see how he looked. "Well?" Will paused the DVD. I straightened up. "I'm not sure I like seeing this much of your face. It's a bit unnerving." "Feels cold," he observed, moving his head from left to right, as if testing the feel of it. "Hold on," I said. "I'll get two mirrors, then you can see it properly. But don't move. There's still a bit of tidying up to be done. Possibly an ear to slice." I was in the bedroom, going through his drawers in search of a small mirror, when I heard the door. Two sets of brisk footsteps, Mrs. Trainor's voice lifted, anxious. "Georgina, please don't." The door to the living room was wrenched open. I grabbed the mirror and ran out of the room. I had no intention of being found absent again. Mrs. Trainor was standing in the living room doorway, both hands raised to her mouth, apparently witnessing some unseen confrontation.
"You are the most selfish man I ever met," a young woman was shouting. "I can't believe this, Will. You were selfish then, and you're worse now."
"Georgina," Mrs. Trainor's gaze flicked toward me as I approached.
"Please stop."
I walked into the room behind her. Will, the towel around his shoulders, soft brown fronds of hair at the wheels of his chair, was facing a young woman. She had long dark hair pinned into a messy knot at the back of her head. Her skin was tanned, and she was wearing expensively distressed jeans and suede boots. Like Alicia, her features were beautiful and regular, her teeth the astonishing white of a toothpaste commercial. I knew they were because, her face puce with anger, she was still hissing at him.
"I can't believe it! I can't believe you would even think of it! What do you—"
"Please, Georgina!" Mrs. Trainor's voice lifted sharply.
"This is not the time!"
Will, his face impassive, was staring straight ahead of him at some unseen point.
Will? Do you need any help?" I said, quietly.
"Who are you?"
the young woman said, whipping around. It was then that I saw her eyes were filled with tears.
"Georgina," Will said, "meet Louisa Clark, my paid companion and shockingly inventive hairdresser. Louisa, meet my sister, Georgina. She appears to have flown all the way from Australia to shriek at me."
"Don't be facile," Georgina said. "Mummy told me. She's told me everything."
Nobody moved.
"Shall I give you a minute?" I said. "That would be a good idea."
Mrs. Trainor's knuckles were white on the arm of the sofa. I slid out of the room.
"In fact, Louisa, perhaps now would be a good time to take your lunch break."
It was going to be a bus shelter kind of a day.
I grabbed my sandwiches from the kitchen, climbed into my coat, and set off down the back path. As I left, I could hear Georgina Trainor's voice lifting inside the house.
"Has it ever occurred to you, Will, that, believe it or not, this might not be just about you?"
When I returned, exactly half an hour later, the house was silent. Nathan was washing a mug in the kitchen sink. He turned as he saw me.
How are you doing?
Has she gone?
Who?
The sister.
He glanced behind him. Ah, that who it was. Yeah, she's gone. Just getting off in her car when I got here. Some sort of family row, was it?
I don't know, I said. I was in the middle of cutting Will's hair, and this woman came in and just started having a go at him. I assumed it was another girlfriend.
Nathan shrugged.
I realized he wouldn't be interested in the personal minutiae of Will's life, even if he knew.
He's a bit quiet, though. Nice work with the shave, by the way. Good to get him out from behind all that shrubbery.
I walked back into the living room. Will was sitting staring at the television, which was still paused at the exact moment I'd left it. "Do you want me to turn this back on?" I said. He didn't seem to hear me for a minute. His head was sunk in his shoulders, the earlier relaxed expression replaced by a veil. Will was closed off again, locked behind something I couldn't penetrate. He blinked, as if he'd only just noticed me there.
"Sure," he said.
I was carrying a basket of washing down the hall when I heard them. The annex door was slightly ajar, and the voices of Mrs. Traynor and her daughter carried down the long corridor, the sound coming in muted waves. Will's sister was sobbing quietly, all fury gone from her voice now. She sounded almost childlike. "There must be something they can do, some medical advance. Can't you take him to America? Things are always improving in America." "Your father keeps a very close eye on all the developments. But no, darling, there's nothing concrete. He's so different now. It's like he's determined not to see the good in anything." "He's been like that since the start, George. I think it's just that you didn't see him apart from when you flew home. Back then, I think he was still determined. Back then, he was sure that something would change." I felt a little uncomfortable listening in on such a private conversation, but the odd tenor drew me closer. I found myself walking softly toward the door, my socked feet making no sound on the floor. "Look, Daddy and I didn't tell you. We didn't want to upset you. But he tried..." She struggled over the words. "Will tried to..." "He tried to kill himself."
"What?"
"Daddy found him, back in December. It was terrible." Even though this really only confirmed what I'd guessed, I felt all the blood drain from me. I heard a muffled cry, a whispered reassurance. There was another long silence. And then Georgina, her voice thick with grief, spoke again.
"The girl?"
"Yes. Louisa is here to make sure nothing like that happens again."
I stopped. At the other end of the corridor, from the bathroom, I could hear Nathan and Will talking in a low murmur, comfortably oblivious to the conversation that was going on just a few feet away. I took a step closer to the door. I suppose I had known it since I caught sight of the scars on his wrists. It made sense of everything, after all. Mrs. Traynor's anxiety that I shouldn't leave Will alone for very long, his antipathy to having me there, the fact that for large stretches of time I didn't feel like I was doing anything useful at all. I'd been babysitting. I hadn't known it. But Will had. And he'd hated me for it.
I reached for the handle of the door, preparing to close it gently. I wondered what Nathan knew. I wondered whether Will was happier now. I realized I felt, selfishly, a faint relief that it hadn't been me Will objected to, just the fact that anyone had been employed to watch over him.
You can't let him do this, Mum. You have to stop him.
It's not our choice, darling.
But it is. It is, if he's asking you to be part of it, Georgina protested.
The handle stilled in my hand.
I can't believe you're even agreeing to it. What about your religion? What about everything you've done? What was the point in you even bloody saving him the last time?
Mrs. Traynor's voice was deliberately calm. That's not fair.
But you've said you'll take him. What does... Do you think for a moment that if I said I refuse, he wouldn't ask someone else? But Dignitas? It's just wrong. I know it's hard for him, but it will destroy you and Daddy. I know it. Think of how you would feel. Think of the publicity, your job, both your reputations. He must know it. It's a selfish thing to even ask. How can he? How can he do this? How can you do this?
She began to sob again. George.
Don't look at me like that. I do care about him, Mummy. I do. He's my brother and I love him. But I can't bear it. I can't bear even the thought of it. He's wrong to ask, and you're wrong to consider it. And it's not just his own life he will destroy if you go ahead with this.
I took a step back from the window. The blood thumped so loudly in my ears that I almost didn't hear Mrs. Traynor's response. 6 months, George. He promised to give me 6 months. Now, I don't want you to mention this again, and certainly not in front of anyone else. And we must... She took a deep breath. We must just pray very hard that something happens in that time to change his mind.
Chapter 8. Camilla. I never set out to help kill my son. Even reading the words seems odd, like something you might see in a tabloid newspaper. I was not the kind of person this happened to, or at least I thought I wasn't. My life was a fairly structured one, an ordinary one by modern standards. I had been married for almost 37 years. I raised 2 children, I kept my career, helped out at the school, the PTA, and joined the bench. Once the children didn't need me any more. I had been a magistrate for almost 11 years. I watched the whole of human life come through my court. The hopeless waifs who couldn't get themselves together sufficiently even to make a court appointment on time. The repeat offenders. The angry, hard-faced young men. And exhausted, debt-ridden mothers. It's quite hard to stay calm and understanding when you see the same faces, the same mistakes made again and again. I could sometimes hear the impatience in my tone. It could be oddly dispiriting, the blank refusal of humankind to even attempt to function responsibly. And our little town, despite the beauty of the castle, our many Grade 2 listed buildings, our picturesque country lanes, was far from immune to it. Our Regency Squares held cider-drinking teenagers. Our thatched cottages muffled the sounds of husbands beating their wives and children. Sometimes I felt like King Canute, making vain pronouncements in the face of a tide of chaos and creeping devastation. But I loved my job. I did it because I believe in order, in a moral code. I believe that there is a right and a wrong. Unfashionable as that view might be. I got through the tougher days because of my garden. As the children grew, it had become a bit of an obsession of mine. I could give you the Latin name of almost any plant you cared to point at. The funny thing was, I didn't even do Latin at school. Mine was a rather minor public school for girls, where the focus was on cooking and embroidery, things that would help us become good wives. But the thing about those plant names is that they do stick in your head. I only ever needed to hear one once to remember it forever. Helleborus niger, Eremurus stenophilus, Atherium nipponicum. I can repeat those with a fluency I never had at school. They say you only really appreciate a garden once you reach a certain age, and I suppose there is a truth in that. It's probably something to do with the great circle of life. There seems to be something miraculous about seeing the relentless optimism of new growth after the bleakness of winter. A kind of joy in the difference every year, the way nature chooses to show off different parts of the garden to its full advantage. There have been times, the times when my marriage proved to be somewhat more populated than I had anticipated, when it has been a refuge, times when it has been a joy. There have even been times when it was, frankly, a pain. There is nothing more disappointing than creating a new border only to see it fail to flourish, or to watch a row of beautiful alliums destroyed overnight by some slimy culprit. But even when I complained about the time, the effort involved in caring for it, the way my joints protested an afternoon spent weeding, or my fingernails never looking quite clean, I loved it. I loved the sensual pleasures of being outside, the smell of it, the feel of the earth under my fingers, the satisfaction of seeing things living, glowing, captivated by their own temporary beauty. After Will's accident, I didn't garden for a year. It wasn't just the time, although the endless hours spent at the hospital, the time spent to-ing and fro-ing in the car, the meetings, oh God, the meetings, took up so much of it. I took 6 months' compassionate leave from work, and there was still not enough of it. It was that I could suddenly see no point. I paid a gardener to come and keep the garden tidy, and I don't think I gave it anything but the most cursory of looks for the best part of a year. It was only when we brought Will back home, once the annex was adapted and ready, that I could see a point in making it beautiful again. I needed to give my son something to look at. I needed to tell him, silently, that things might change, grow or fail, but that life did go on. That we were all part of some great cycle, some pattern that it was only God's purpose to understand. I couldn't say that to him, of course. Will and I have never been able to say much to each other, but I wanted to show him. A silent promise, if you like, that there was a bigger picture, a brighter future. Stephen was poking at the log fire. He manoeuvred the remaining half-burnt logs expertly with a poker, sending glowing sparks up the chimney, then dropped a new log onto the middle. He stood back, as he always did, watching with quiet satisfaction as the flames took hold, and dusted his hands on his corduroy trousers. He turned as I entered the room. I held out a glass.
"Thank you. Is George coming down?"
"Apparently not."
"What's she doing?"
"Watching television upstairs. She doesn't want company. I did ask."
"She'll come round. She's probably jet-lagged."
"I hope so, Stephen. She's not very happy with us at the moment." We stood in silence, watching the fire. Around us the room was dark and still, the window panes rattling gently as they were buffeted by the wind and rain.
"Filthy night."
"Yes." The dog padded into the room, and with a sigh flopped down in front of the fire, gazing up adoringly at us both from her prone position.
So, what do you think? He said, this haircut business.
I don't know. I'd like to think it's a good sign.
This Louisa's a bit of a character, isn't she?
I saw the way my husband smiled to himself. Not her, too. I found myself thinking, and then squashed the thought. Yes. Yes, I suppose she is.
Do you think she's the right one?
I took a sip of my drink before answering. Two fingers of gin, a slice of lemon, and a lot of tonic. Who knows? I said. I don't think I have the faintest idea what is right and wrong any more.
He likes her. I'm sure he likes her. We were talking while watching the news the other night, and he mentioned her twice. He hasn't done that before.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't get your hopes up.
Do you have to?
Stephen turned from the fire. I could see him studying me, perhaps conscious of the new lines around my eyes, the way my mouth seemed set these days into a thin line of anxiety. He looked at the little gold cross, now ever present around my neck. I didn't like it when he looked at me like that. I could never escape the feeling that I was being compared to someone else. I'm just being realistic.
You sound like you're already expecting it to happen.
I know my son.
Our son.
Yes, our son. More my son, I found myself thinking. You were never really there for him, not emotionally. You were just the absence he was always striving to impress.
He'll change his mind,
Stephen said.
There's still a long way to go.
We stood there. I took a long sip of my drink, the ice cold against the warmth given out by the fire. I keep thinking, I said, staring into the hearth. I still keep thinking that I'm missing something. My husband was still watching me. I could feel his gaze on me, but I couldn't meet it. Perhaps he might have reached out to me then. But I think we'd probably gone too far for that. He took a sip of his drink.
You can only do what you can do, darling.
I'm well aware of that, but it's not really enough, is it? He turned back to the fire, poking unnecessarily at a log, until I turned and quietly left the room, as he had known I would. When Will first told me what he wanted, he had to tell me twice, as I was quite sure I could not have heard him correctly the first time. I stayed quite calm when I realized what he was proposing, and then I told him he was being ridiculous, and I walked straight out of the room. It's an unfair advantage being able to walk away from a man in a wheelchair. There are two steps between the annex and the main house, and without Nathan's help, he could not traverse them. I shut the door of the annex, and I stood in my own hallway, with the calmly spoken words of my son still ringing in my ears. I'm not sure I moved for half an hour. He refused to let it go. Being Will, he always had to have the last word. He repeated his request every time I went in to see him, until I almost had to persuade myself to go in each day.
I don't want to live like this, Mother. This is not the life I chose.
There is no prospect of my recovery. Hence it is a perfectly reasonable request to ask to end it in a manner I see fit. I heard him, and could well imagine what he had been like in those business meetings, the career that had made him rich and arrogant. He was a man who was used to being heard, after all. He couldn't bear it that in some way I had the power to dictate his future, that I had somehow become mother again. It took his attempt to make me agree. It's not that my religion forbade it, although the prospect of Will being consigned to hell through his own desperation was a terrible one. I chose to believe that God, a benign God, would understand our sufferings and forgive us our trespasses. It's just that the thing you never understand about being a mother until you are one is that it is not the grown man, The galumphing, unshaven, stinking, opinionated offspring you see before you, with his parking tickets and unpolished shoes and complicated love life. You see all the people he has ever been, all rolled up into one. I looked at Will, and I saw the baby I held in my arms, dewily besotted, unable to believe that I had created another human being. I saw the toddler reaching for my hand, the schoolboy weeping tears of fury after being bullied by some other child. I saw the vulnerabilities, the love, the history. That's what he was asking me to extinguish. The small child as well as the man. All that love. All that history. And then, on the 22nd of January, a day when I was stuck in court with a relentless roll call of shoplifters and uninsured drivers, of weeping, angry ex-partners, Stephen walked into the annex and found our son almost unconscious, his head lolling by his armrest, a sea of dark, sticky blood pooling around his wheels. He had located a rusty nail, barely half an inch emerging from some hurriedly finished woodwork in the back lobby, and, pressing his wrist against it, had moved his wheelchair backward and forward until his flesh was sliced to ribbons. I cannot to this day imagine the determination that kept him going, even though he must have been half delirious from the pain. The doctor said he was less than 20 minutes from death. It was not, they observed with exquisite understatement, a cry for help. When they told me at the hospital that Will would live, I walked outside into my garden and I raged. I raged at God, at nature, at whatever fate had brought our family to such depths. Now I look back, and I must have seemed quite mad. I stood in my garden that cold evening, and I hurled my large brandy 20 feet into the euonymus compactus, and I screamed, so that my voice broke the air, bouncing off the castle walls and echoing into the distance. I was so furious, you see, that all around me were things that could move and bend and grow and reproduce, and my son, my vital, charismatic, beautiful boy, was just this thing. Immobile, wilted, blooded, suffering. Their beauty seemed like an obscenity. I screamed, and I screamed, and I swore. Words I didn't know I knew, until Stephen came out and stood, his hand resting on my shoulder, waiting until he could be sure that I would be silent again. He didn't understand, you see. He hadn't worked it out yet, that Will would try again. That our lives would have to be spent in a state of constant vigilance, waiting for the next time, waiting to see what horror he would inflict upon himself. We would have to see the world through his eyes, the potential poisons, the sharp objects, the inventiveness with which he could finish the job that damned motorcyclist had started. Our lives had to shrink, to fit around the potential for that one act. And he had the advantage. He had nothing else to think about, you see. 2 weeks later, I told Will. Yes. Of course I did. What else could I have done?
Chapter 9. I didn't sleep that night. I lay awake in the little box room, gazing up at the ceiling, and carefully reconstructing the last 2 months, based on what I now knew. It was as if everything had shifted, fragmented and settled in some other place, into a pattern I barely recognized. I felt duped, the dim-witted accessory who hadn't known what was going on. I felt they must have laughed privately at my attempts to feed Will vegetables or cut his hair, little things to make him feel better. What had been the point? I ran over and over the conversation I'd heard, trying to interpret it in some alternative way, trying to convince myself that I'd misunderstood what they'd said. But Dignitas wasn't exactly somewhere you went for a mini-break. I couldn't believe Camilla Trainor could contemplate doing that to her son. Yes, I had thought her cold and, yes, awkward around him. It was hard to imagine her cuddling him as my mother had cuddled us, fiercely, joyously, until we wriggled away, begging to be let go. If I'm honest, I just thought it was how the upper classes were with their children. I'd just read Will's copy of Love in a Cold Climate, after all. But to actively, to voluntarily play a part in her own son's death. With hindsight, her behaviour seemed even colder, her actions imbued with some sinister intent. I was angry with her, and angry with Will, angry with them for letting me engage in a facade. I was angry for all the times I'd sat and thought about how to make things better for him, how to make him comfortable or happy. When I wasn't angry, I was sad. I would recall the slight break in her voice as she tried to comfort Georgina, and feel a great sadness for her. She was, I knew, in an impossible position. But mostly, I felt filled with horror. I was haunted by what I now knew. How could you live each day, knowing that you were simply whiling away the days until your own death? How could this man, whose skin I'd felt that morning under my fingers, warm and alive, choose to just extinguish himself? How could it be that with everyone's consent, in 4 months' time, that same skin would be decaying under the ground? I couldn't tell anyone. That was almost the worst bit. I was now complicit in the trainer's secret. I refused supper. I lay in bed until my thoughts darkened and solidified to the point where I couldn't bear the weight of them, and at 8:30 I came back downstairs and sat silently watching television, perched on the other side of Grandad, who was the only person in our family guaranteed not to ask me a question. He sat in his favourite armchair and stared at the screen with glassy-eyed intensity. I was never sure whether he was watching or whether his mind was somewhere else entirely. "Are you sure I can't get you something, love?" Mum appeared at my side with a cup of tea. There was nothing in our family that couldn't be improved by a cup of tea, allegedly. "No, not hungry, thanks." I saw the way she glanced at Dad. I knew that later on there would be private mutterings, that the trainers were working me too hard, that the strain of looking after such an invalid was proving too much. I knew they would blame themselves for encouraging me to take the job. I would have to let them think they were right. Paradoxically, the following day, Will was in good form, unusually talkative, opinionated, belligerent. He talked, possibly more than he had talked on any previous day. It was as if he wanted to spar with me, and was disappointed when I wouldn't play.
"So, when are you going to finish this hatchet job, then?"
I'd been tidying the living room. I looked up from plumping the sofa cushions.
"What?"
"My hair. I'm only half done. I look like one of those Victorian orphans." He turned his head so that I could better see my handiwork.
"Unless this is one of your alternative style statements."
"You want me to keep cutting?"
"Well, it seemed to keep you happy. And it would be nice not to look like I belong in an asylum."
I fetched a towel and scissors in silence.
"Nathan is definitely happier now that I apparently look like a bloke," he said.
Although he did point out that having restored my face to its former state, I will now need shaving every day.
Oh, I said.
You don't mind, do you? Weekends I'll just have to put up with designer stubble.
I couldn't talk to him. I found it difficult even to meet his eye. It was like finding out your boyfriend had been unfaithful. I felt, weirdly, as if he'd betrayed me.
Clark?
Hmm?
You're having another unnervingly quiet day. What happened to chatty to the point of vaguely irritating?
Sorry, I said.
Running man again? What's he done now? He hasn't gone and run off, has he?
No. I took a soft slice of Will's hair between my index and middle fingers and lifted the blades of the scissors to trim what lay exposed above them. They stilled in my hand. How would they do it? Would they give him an injection? Was it medicine? Or did they just leave you in a room with a load of razors?
You look tired. I wasn't going to say anything when you came in, but, hell, you look terrible.
Oh. How did they assist someone who couldn't move their own limbs? I found myself gazing down at his wrists, which were always covered by long sleeves. I'd assumed for weeks that this was because he felt the cold more than we did. Another lie.
Clark?
Yes? I was glad I was behind him. I didn't want him to see my face. He hesitated. Where the back of his neck had been covered by hair, it was even paler than the rest of his skin. It looked soft and white and oddly vulnerable.
Look, I'm sorry about my sister. She was very upset, but it didn't give her the right to be rude. She's a bit direct sometimes. Doesn't know how much she rubs people the wrong way.
He paused.
It's why she likes living in Australia, I think.
You mean they tell each other the truth?
What?
Nothing. Lift your head up, please. I snipped and combed, working my way methodically around his head until every single hair was chopped or trimmed, and all that remained was a fine sprinkling on the floor. It all became clear to me by the end of the day. While Will was watching television with his father, I took a sheet of paper from the printer and a pen from the jar by the kitchen window, and wrote down what I wanted to say. I folded the paper, found an envelope, and left it on the kitchen table, addressed to his mother. When I left for the evening, Will and his father were talking. Actually, Will was laughing. I paused in the hallway, my bag over my shoulder, listening. Why would he laugh? What could possibly provoke mirth, given that he had just a matter of weeks before he took his own life?
I'm off,
I called through the doorway and started walking.
Hey, Clark,
he began, but I'd already closed the door behind me. I spent the short bus ride trying to work out what I was going to tell my parents. They would be furious that I'd left what they would see as a perfectly suitable and well-paid job. After her initial shock, my mother would look pained and defend me, suggesting that it had all been too much. My father would probably ask why I couldn't be more like my sister. He often did, even though I wasn't the one who ruined her life by getting pregnant and having to rely on the rest of the family for financial support and babysitting. You weren't allowed to say anything like that in our house because, according to my mother, it was like implying that Thomas wasn't a blessing, and all babies were God's blessing, even those who said, bugger, quite a lot, and whose presence meant that half the potential wage earners in our family couldn't actually go and get a decent job.
I would not be able to tell them the truth. I knew I owed Will and his family nothing, but I wouldn't inflict the curious gaze of the neighborhood on him. All these thoughts tumbled around my head as I got off the bus and walked down the hill. And then I got to the corner of our road and heard the shouting, felt the slight vibration in the air, and it was all briefly forgotten. A small crowd had gathered around our house. I picked up my pace, afraid that something had happened, but then I saw my parents on the porch peering up and realized it wasn't our house at all. It was just the latest in a long series of small wars that characterized our neighbor's marriage. That Richard Grisham was not the most faithful of husbands was hardly news on our street, but judging by the scene in his front garden, it might have been to his wife.
"You must have thought I was bloody stupid. She was wearing your T-shirt, the one I had made for you for your birthday."
"Baby, Dimpner, it's not what you think.
I went in for your bloody Scotch eggs, and there she was, wearing it, bold as brass, and I don't even like Scotch eggs."
I slowed my pace, pushing my way through the small crowd until I was able to get to our gate, watching as Richard ducked to avoid a DVD player. Next came a pair of shoes. How long have they been at it? My mother, her apron tucked neatly around her waist, unfolded her arms and glanced down at her watch. "It's a good 3/4 of an hour. Bernard, would you say it's a good 3/4 of an hour?
"Depends if you time it for when she threw the clothes out or when he came back and found them."
"I'd say when he came home."
Dad considered this.
"Then it's really closer to 1/2 an hour. She got a good lot out of the window in the first 15 minutes, though."
"Your dad says if she really does kick him out this time, he's going to put in a bid for Richard's Black & Decker." The crowd had grown, and Dimpner Grisham showed no sign of letting up. If anything, she seemed encouraged by the increasing size of her audience.
"You can take her, your filthy books," she yelled, hurling a shower of magazines out the window. These prompted a small cheer among the crowd. "See if she likes you sitting in the loo with those for half of Sunday afternoon, eh?"
She disappeared inside and then reappeared at the window, hauling the contents of a laundry basket down onto what remained of the lawn.
"And your filthy underwear. See if she thinks you're such a... what was it? Hot stud when she's washing those for you every day."
Richard was vainly scooping up armfuls of his stuff as it landed on the grass. He was yelling something up at the window, but against the general noise and catcalls, it was hard to make it out. Oddly, whereas his CD collection and video games had been quite popular, no one made a move on his dirty laundry. Crash! There was a brief hush as his stereo met the path. He looked up in disbelief.
"You crazy bitch! You're shagging that disease-ridden cross-eyed troll from the garage, and I'm the crazy bitch!"
My mother turned to my father. "Would you like a cup of tea, Bernard? I think it's turning a little chilly." My dad didn't take his eyes off next door.
"That'd be great, love. Thank you."
It was as my mother went indoors that I noticed the car. It was so unexpected that at first I didn't recognize it. Mrs. Traynor's Mercedes, navy blue, low slung, and discreet. She pulled up, peering out at the scene on the pavement, and hesitated a moment before she climbed out. She stood, staring at the various houses, perhaps checking the numbers. And then she saw me. I slid out from the porch and was down the path before Dad could ask where I was going. Mrs. Traynor stood to the side of the crowd, gazing at the chaos like Marie Antoinette viewing a load of rioting peasants. "Domestic dispute," I said. She looked away as if almost embarrassed to have been caught looking.
I see.
It's a fairly constructive one by their standards. They've been going to marriage counselling.
Her elegant wool suit, pearls and expensive hair were enough to mark her out on our street, among the sweatpants and cheap fabrics in bright chain store colours. She appeared rigid, worse than the morning she'd come home to find me sleeping in Will's room. I registered in some distant part of my mind that I was not going to miss Camilla Traynor.
"I was wondering if you and I could have a little talk." She had to lift her voice to be heard over the cheering. I glanced over at the crowd and then behind me at the house. I could not imagine bringing Mrs. Traynor into our front room with its litter of toy trains, Granddad snoring mutely in front of the television, Mum spraying air freshener around to hide the smell of Dad's socks, and Thomas popping by to murmur, "Bugger," at the new guest.
It's not a great time.
Perhaps we could talk in my car. Look, just 5 minutes, Louisa. Surely you owe us that. A couple of my neighbours glanced in my direction as I climbed into the car. I was lucky that the Grishams were the hot news of the evening, or I might have been the topic of conversation. On our street, if you climbed into an expensive car, it meant you had either pulled a footballer or were being arrested by plainclothes police. The doors closed with an expensive, muted clunk, and suddenly there was silence. The car smelled of leather, and there was nothing in it apart from me and Mrs. Traynor. No candy wrappers, mud, lost toys, or perfumed dangly things to disguise the smell of the carton of milk that had been dropped in there 3 months earlier. "I thought you and Will got on well." She spoke as if addressing someone straight ahead of her. When I didn't speak, she said, "Is there a problem with the money?"
"No."
"Do you need a longer lunch break? I am conscious that it's rather short. I could ask Nathan if he would..." "It's not the hours, or the money."
"Then... I don't really want to..."
"Look, you cannot hand in your notice with immediate effect and expect me not even to ask what on earth's the matter." I took a deep breath. "I overheard you. You and your daughter. Last night. And I don't want to... I don't want to be part of it."
"Ah."
We sat in silence. Mr. Grisham was now trying to bash his way in through the front door, and Mrs. Grisham was busy hurling anything she could locate through the window down onto his head. The choice of projectile missiles, loo roll, tampon boxes, toilet brush, shampoo bottles, suggested she was now in the bathroom.
"Please, don't leave," Mrs. Traynor said quietly. "Will is comfortable with you. More so than he's been for some time. It would be very hard for us to replicate that with someone else."
"But you're going to take him to that place where people commit suicide. Dignitas."
"No. I'm going to do everything I can to ensure he doesn't do that."
"Like what? Praying?"
Mrs. Traynor gave me what my mother would have termed an old-fashioned look. "You must know by now that if Will decides to make himself unreachable, there is little anybody can do about it." "I worked it all out," I said. "I'm basically there just to make sure he doesn't cheat and do it before his 6 months are up. That's it, isn't it?"
"No, that's not it."
"Which is why you didn't care about my qualifications." "I thought you were bright and cheerful and different. You didn't look like a nurse. You didn't behave like any of the others.
I thought you might cheer him up. And you do cheer him up, Louisa. Seeing him without that awful beard yesterday. You seem to be one of the few people who are able to get through to him. Don't you think it would have been fair to mention that I was basically on suicide watch? The sigh Camilla Traynor gave was the sound of someone forced to explain something politely to an imbecile. I wondered if she knew that everything she said made the other person feel like an idiot. I wondered if it was something she'd actually cultivated deliberately. I didn't think I could ever manage to make someone feel inferior. That might have been the case when we first met you. But I'm confident Will is going to stick to his word. He has promised me 6 months, and that's what I'll get. We need this time, Louisa. We need this time to give him the idea of there being some possibility. I was hoping it might plant the idea that there is a life he could enjoy, even if it wasn't the life he had planned. But it's all lies. You've lied to me, and you're all lying to each other. She didn't seem to hear me. She turned to face me, pulling a checkbook from her handbag, a pen ready in her hand. Look, what do you want? I will double your money. Tell me how much you want. I don't want your money. A car, some benefits, bonuses. No. Then, what can I do that might change your mind? I'm sorry, I just don't... I started to get out of the car. Her hand shot out. It sat there on my arm, strange and radioactive. We both stared at it. You signed a contract, Miss Clark, she said. You signed a contract where you promised to work for us for 6 months. By my calculations, you have done only two. I am simply requiring you to fulfill your contractual obligations. Her voice had become brittle. I looked down at Mrs. Traynor's hand and saw that it was trembling. She swallowed. Please. My parents were watching from the porch. I could see them, mugs poised in their hands, the only two people facing away from the theatre next door. They turned away awkwardly when they saw that I'd noticed them. Dad, I realized, was wearing the tartan slippers with the paint splotches. I pushed the handle of the door. Mrs. Traynor, I really can't sit by and watch. It's too weird. I don't want to be part of this. Just think about it. Tomorrow is Good Friday. I'll tell Will you have a family commitment if you really just need some time. Take the bank holiday weekend to think about it, but please, come back. Come back and help him. I walked back into the house without looking back. I sat down in the living room and stared at the television, while my parents followed me in, exchanged glances, and pretended not to be watching me. It was almost 11 minutes before I finally heard Mrs. Traynor's car start up and drive away. My sister confronted me within 5 minutes of arriving home, thundering up the stairs and throwing open the door of my room. "Yes, do come in," I said. I was lying on the bed, my legs stretched up the wall, staring at the ceiling. I was wearing tights and blue sequined shorts, which now looped unattractively around the tops of my legs. Katrina stood in the doorway. "Is it true?" "That Dimpna Grisham has finally thrown out her cheating, no-good-for-landering husband at Don't Be Smart. About your job." I traced the pattern of the wallpaper with my big toe. "Yes," I handed in my notice. "Yes, I know Mum and Dad are not too happy about it. Yes, yes, yes to whatever it is you're going to throw at me."
She closed the door carefully behind her, then sat down heavily on the end of my bed and swore lustily.
"I don't bloody believe you."
She shoved my legs so that I slid down the wall, ending up almost lying on the bed. I pushed myself upright.
"Ow!"
Her face was puce.
"I don't believe you. Mum's in bits downstairs. Dad's pretending not to be, but he is too. What are they supposed to do about money? You know Dad's already panicking about work. Why the hell would you throw away a perfectly good job?"
"Don't lecture me, Treen."
"Well, someone's got to. You're never going to get anything like that money anywhere else. And how's it going to look on your CV?
"Oh, don't pretend this is about anything other than you and what you want."
"What? You don't care what I do, as long as you can still go and resurrect your high-flying career. You just need me there propping up the family funds and providing the bloody childcare. Sod everyone else."
I knew I sounded mean and nasty, but I couldn't help myself. It was my sister's plight that had got us into this mess, after all. Years of resentment began to ooze out of me.
"We've all got to stick at jobs we hate just so that little Katrina can fulfill her bloody ambitions."
"It is not about me."
"No?"
"No, it's about you not being able to stick at the one decent job you've been offered in months."
"You know nothing about my job, okay?"
"I know it paid well above the minimum wage, which is all I need to know about it."
"Not everything in life is about the money, you know."
"Yes, you go downstairs and tell Mum and Dad that."
"Don't you dare bloody lecture me about money when you haven't paid a sodding thing toward this house for years. You know I can't afford much because of Thomas."
I began to shove my sister out the door. I can't remember the last time I actually laid a hand on her, but right then I wanted to punch someone quite badly, and I was afraid of what I would do if she stayed there in front of me.
"Just piss off, Treen, okay? Just piss off and leave me alone."
I slammed the door in my sister's face, and when I finally heard her walking slowly back down the stairs, I chose not to think about what she would say to my parents, about the way they would all treat this as further evidence of my catastrophic inability to do anything of any worth. I chose not to think about Sayid at the job centre, and how I would explain my reasons for leaving this most well-paid of menial jobs. I chose not to think about the chicken factory, and how somewhere, deep within its bowels, there was probably a set of plastic overalls and a hygiene cap with my name still on them. I lay back, and I thought about Will. I thought about his anger and his sadness. I thought about what his mother had said, that I was one of the only people able to get through to him. I thought about him trying not to laugh at the Mullahunky song on a night when the snow drifted gold past the window. I thought about the warm skin and soft hair and hands of someone living, someone who was far cleverer and funnier than I would ever be, and who still couldn't see a better future than to obliterate himself. And finally, my head pressed into the pillow, I cried, because my life suddenly seemed so much darker and more complicated than I could ever have imagined, and I wished I could go back to when my biggest worry was whether Frank and I had ordered in enough Chelsea buns. There was a knock on the door. I blew my nose.
"Piss off, Katrina."
"I'm sorry." I stared at the door. Her voice was muffled, as if her lips were close up to the keyhole.
"I've got wine. Look, let me in for God's sake, or Mum'll hear me. I've got 2 Bob the Builder mugs stuck up my sweater, and you know how she gets about us drinking upstairs."
I climbed off the bed and opened the door. She glanced up at my tear-stained face and swiftly closed the bedroom door behind her.
"Okay," she said,
wrenching off the screw top and pouring me a mug of wine. What really happened? I looked at my sister hard.